Another school kidnapping in northern Nigeria, another release, another denial of ransom payments. The freeing of 279 girls in Zamfara State means relief for parents and concern over what's now becoming a pattern. We're far from 2014, when the whole planet picked up on the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls with the abduction of the Chibok schoolgirls by Boko Haram in the Northeast. Now, it's all of the North, and it's not about ideology. It seems to be strictly business. How to shut down the cottage industry that's become the mass abduction of boarding school pupils. President Muhammadu Buhari, himself from the North, recently purged his military command in the face of the outcry and called out state governors. But is a military approach what's needed to get to the root of the matter? Once again, we're back to asking what it will take to help develop the north of Africa's most populous nation. Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at Nigeria's wave of school kidnappings. With us, academic and consultant Emmanuel Iga. How are you, sir?
Very fine. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks as well to Blessing Iboma, president of the advocacy group Hope Up for Refugees. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We also want to welcome from Warsaw, Drew Hinshaw, senior reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Congratulations on the release of your new book. You're the co-author of Bring Back Our Girls, The Untold Story of the Global Search for Nigeria's Missing Schoolgirls.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
The France 24 debate on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24debate. Yeah, all 279 schoolgirls, safe and sound. It's the third such mass kidnapping in less than 3 months. Jean-Emile Jamin has more.
Back safe and unharmed, now free to reunite with their loved ones. These were just some of the almost 300 girls released on Tuesday after they were kidnapped by gunmen from their school in a remote Nigerian village last week. For some, the emotion was too much to bear, having feared the worst for their daughters.
I'm happy.
Most of the girls appeared to be unharmed, but at least a dozen were sent to hospital for treatment.
Most of us got injured on our feet and we could not continue walking. So our captors said they would shoot anybody who did not continue to move.
Upon the news of their release, President Muhammadu Buhari expressed his overwhelming joy while vowing that the military would continue to pursue the kidnappers. Government, however, denied having paid a ransom to the so-called bandits for the girls' release.
And those repentant ones are working for us, and they are working for the government, they are working for the security. So we're going to continue with that process, because not all of them that are bad, like the one that we use to secure the release of these children.
This was just the latest in a series of abductions endured by schoolchildren in northern and central Nigeria. More than 600 students have been kidnapped in separate incidents over the past 3 months. On Friday, 27 teenage boys were set free, having been taken from their school in Niger State 2 weeks ago, while in December, the kidnapping and later release of more than 300 boys from a school in Kankara triggered widespread outrage, also bringing back memories of the abduction of hundreds of Chibok schoolgirls by jihadists in 2014.
Yeah, no ransom paid, insist authorities, but that claim met with skepticism, particularly following a tweet last week by President Buhari warning state governments against, quote, rewarding bandits with money and vehicles. State and local governments must also play their part, he goes on to say, by being proactive and improving security in and around schools. Who is he referring to when he talks about rewarding the bandits with money and vehicles? What's he referring to there?
Well, we had the initial kidnapping, mass kidnapping that was done in 2014. You talked about it in the introduction. That was that of the Chibok girls. That was done by Boko Haram. And it was an ideology-based, motivated by ideology-based kidnapping, let me say. Now we are having this new kind of new layer of kidnapping that is becoming more and more frequent. And the government seems to be saying these kidnappings are being done by what they call bandits. Bandits. So they are supposed to be like criminals, ordinary criminals. And if you look at the pattern, as you said, you know, it's becoming very frequent and sustained. So in less than 3 months, we've had more than 4 mass kidnappings that have taken place, and hundreds of schoolgirls involved, and passengers traveling from city to city involved. And each time we get negotiations that are done and that lead to the release of the entire hostages in most cases, except that in the case of the 27 boys, I think they talked about one of the boys that was killed. So if they are kidnapping very frequently in a sustained manner and releases are taking place, then there is something like something that is motivating. So what is it motivating? And Nigerians don't see anything else than probably money changing hands to these so-called bandits, these criminals, behind the scene, although the government is saying we don't pay ransoms. So if Buhari, the president, is talking about, well, this no rewarding, etc., he's talking about the so-called bandits. So we are still waiting for a clear definition of who these bandits are.
So we're still waiting for a clear definition. Blessing Iboma, do you agree with President Buhari when he says that the state governments must review their policy of rewarding bandits with money and vehicles?
I do, because, I mean, the governor of Zamfara, he actually made a statement that when they repented, bandit comes out and surrender their arms, they'll be sponsored with money and they'll be given home because they've decided to end such act. But I believe the governor have to take an action, not rewarding them with money, but they should be kept within the prison, not being fed with money and houses. And that is not a way to give a way to repented bandits.
You saw in that report the relief on that.
Yeah,
that
I did. In
face, you know. If you're one of the parents, you're desperate. You'll do anything, right, to have your children released.
I will, especially as a mother. I will. I mean, in the north alone, it's very discouraging to see what is happening right now, because it's the women themselves are not encouraged to go to school. The northern side, 47% are mostly out of school. More than half of the girls are out of school. So having the bandit, having COVID, It's not encouraging. It's not a way out.
Drew Henshaw, why is this happening now?
There's the security forces don't have control. People can kidnap hundreds of boys or schoolgirls, and whether you pay a ransom, there's no consequences. There's no justice. You know, Boko Haram kidnapped 276 schoolgirls. That was nearly 7 years ago. The government paid a 3 million euro ransom to return 103 of them. You know, you can understand the ethical dilemma there, but the fact stands that the people who did that remain at large. There's no justice. There's no consequences for this behavior.
All right, one of the measures that's been taken in the last 24 hours is the government imposing a no-fly zone over Zamfara State. Authorities warning against bandits using the ill-gotten gains from local gold mines to ship weapons and fly out precious metals. Does that sound plausible to you, Drew Henshaw?
I don't know. I don't know. What seems clear here is that there's a pattern of these are becoming express kidnappings. Every other day, you know, there's 3 kidnappings in 2 months. They're resolved within 48 hours. We know some kind of ransom's paid because the schoolgirls of this latest one told our colleagues in Nigeria that, you know, their captors were celebrating, firing guns in the air, saying the money had been delivered. So I don't know what the ransom is. In some of these cases, it seems to have been the equivalent of tens of thousands of euros. The amount almost is inconsequential compared to the fact that you can do this and get away with it and do it again and again and again.
get away with it again and again. I want at this point to bring in from the Nigerian capital, Abuja, consultant Najima Animashaun. Thank you for joining us here in the France 24 debate. Your reaction to what you just heard there from Drew Hinshaw.
Well, thank you for having me, Francois. It's a pleasure to be on your show. One of the interesting things about the kidnappings, there have been two kidnappings recently of schoolgirls, one in Niger State and the other in Zamfara State. And those two states, along with Kebbi and Osun States, are the gold mining centers of Nigeria. Now, one of the things about gold mining is that it's largely artisanal mining and that it has a lot of money laundering associated with it. One of the reasons why the government has shut down the airspace around Zamfara is that we do know that light aircraft are flown in and they land on the road leading out of Gusau between Jibia and Gusau, where the gold mining areas are, which is not far from where these girls were kidnapped. And they pick up gold in the middle of the night and then take it back to the Middle East. So for a no-fly zone, it's probably the only way the government is actually going to be able to monitor this and also stop gold mining. Now, we know that Nigeria produces unrecorded through records from the destinations where Nigerian gold ends up, mainly Dubai, that Nigeria exports approximately 18,000 kilograms of gold. And 1 kilogram is approximately $60,000. So you can imagine the kind of money that's involved in this and the ease at which it can be translated into weapons.
And Najim, connect the dots up for us, if you will, between smuggling of artisanal gold done by panhandlers and these kidnappings.
Well, it's not so much the panhandlers anymore. Much of the gold that's been mined nowadays is small-scale mining. And it involves foreigners, and they are producing, 6 years ago, we were producing about 6,000 kilograms. That was before the mechanization came in and the big earth movers. And so you have strips of land now that are 30, 40 meters deep. And so you've got not so much artisanal miners, although they compete with these mechanized miners. But ultimately what you have is that these artisanal miners, when they make their gold or they pan their gold, do have income that other people want. And there's been a lot of kidnapping in the artisanal mining areas all over Nigeria, not just in Zamfara and not just in Niger State, although those two places happen to be the center of kidnapping for that region. But in parts of Kebbi State where there is, particularly where there is gold, in an area in Kebbi State called Yaoundé, you will find that it is incredibly difficult to drive through that area without a lot of security concerns. In the state of Osun in the southwest, where it's actually a little bit better, there are still kidnappings there, and a Chinese miner recently was abducted. Another Chinese miner was injured severely in a fracas with locals. So it's going on everywhere where there's gold mining, artisanal gold mining, largely because the government isn't regulating the mining. And that's a real problem because Nigeria has actually had its first commercial gold mine operating with a Canadian company that is listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So the opportunity to transform that sector into a properly regulated and a properly functioning sector is there, if only the government would actually step up its regulation and operations of artisanal miners. And the problem with the artisanal miners, particularly the ones using mechanization, are that they have funds, that they are funded by financiers, and those funds may, we don't know, but may include weapons that they bring along with them in order to ensure that they can mine safely.
And that brings us back, Emmanuel Iga, to your original question. who are these, and you use the term cautiously, who are these bandits?
Yes, I think you asked a very good question. How do we connect the dots between the gold artisanal, probably illegal gold miners, and the kidnappers, the bandits or the kidnappers? This is the real question. We have several layers of insecurity now. We have the original one that came from Boko Haram, which is an extremist Islamic movement which doesn't want Western education, which is attacking people on basis of ideology. Then we had, a bit later on, the clashes that were taking place very frequently between Fulani herdsmen, you know, driving their cattle across the country and clashing with communities of farmers. And that has wreaked a lot of havoc, a lot of, you know, killings. That's another layer. And then we are now having a third layer, which is this layer of so-called bandits. The government officially calls them bandits, but we don't know if they are just, if it's the same people or not. They themselves say we are not too sure of the definition. So I think what I can say about this no-fly zones that they are imposing on Zamfara, which Najim has explained very well, is, well, this seems to be targeting the issue of illegal gold mining, which could be probably fueling some of this insecurity. But the key problem...
Try to dry up the money for those who are providing the weapons to these kidnappers?
Well, of course, there is a lot of, you know, weapon trafficking, you know, going on amongst all these layers, the bandits, the headsmen, and the Boko Haram. There is synergy going on, we think so. But what I'm trying to say is that if the gold miners, the illegal gold miners, are working on their gold mines, then how do we see them going to the schools at the same time to kidnap these girls and boys? So if it is the bandits that are doing that, then, and we've imposed a no-fly zone that probably takes care of the illegal gold miners using light aircraft and things like that, then we probably haven't tackled the problem of the kidnappings of school children. The school children were kidnapped in Katsina State, in the president's own state, which doesn't have gold mines, as I think. And it's taking place in Niger State. It's taking place in even in Kaduna and up to... Well, the insecurity is actually in all the 19 northern states of Nigeria. I mean, the serious insecurity, although the general insecurity is across the board in the country. So that's right. The issue. Now, if the bandits are doing the kidnapping, then they are not using aircraft. So the no-fly zone doesn't really solve their problem.
Are you skeptical about the no-fly zone? And we're going to pick up on that when we come back. Stay with us. You're watching the France 24 debate. Welcome back, or welcome if you're just joining us. It's the France 24 debate, and we're looking at the grim cottage industry that seems to be kidnappings for ransom, the kidnappings for ransom of school children. The latest instance ending well for 279 girls in Zamfara State in the northwest of Nigeria. However, it has been begging the question of what is the security apparatus doing and why is it all happening. We're talking about with academic and consultant Emmanuel Iga. Blessing Ibomo, president of the advocacy group Hope Up for Refugees, is with us as well. From Abuja, development consultant Najim Animashaun. And from Warsaw, Drew Hinshaw, senior reporter at the Wall Street Journal, the co-author of Bring Back Our Girls, The Untold Story of the Global Search for Nigeria's Missing Schoolgirls. Drew, in your book, you follow the money when it comes to the Boko Haram abductions.
Right. Yeah, we wanted to kind of know. We wanted to know what was the consequence of millions of us pressing tweet on this hashtag, Bring Back Our Girls. Did it help? Did it hurt? Did it help a little bit and hurt here? And what we sort of came to a conclusion was it had this, like, it lit a fuse of unintended consequences. for people all over the Northeast. And one of those is it affected the negotiations. There were ups and downs over at what price Boko Haram was willing to free these young women that went on for 3 years. At first, they actually weren't looking for money at first. They were looking to, you know, exchange these young women for some of their own prisoners in jail. And that went on for years. I think the state found it easier to deliver money than to go find, you know, 100 prisoners, some of whom might have died in custody. This went on for years. And finally there was a ransom paid. And, you know, thank goodness 103 young women came home. But it does, as all the guests have said, pose this ethical question of ransoms of, well, once you pay that, are you encouraging another and another?
Well, Drew, let's look at this week's news cycle. We've had the latest releases of girls competing with the story of this daring raid by jihadist insurgents in the Northeast. At least 6 killed in Dikwa, that's in Borno State, in an attack that started late on Monday with militants holding a part of the city until midday on Tuesday. And according to aid workers, directly targeting aid facilities in a town where nearly 3/4 of the population is displaced people. You know, you ask the question sitting here in Paris, Drew, is that an attack for ideological purposes, or is that to try to get the hands on the aid?
I think all this is so mixed up. These ideological movements also need to feed their members and raise money. It's so mixed up. The Red Cross has been targeted again and again. They actually played a very important role in freeing the young women. They provided the cars, which is not a small thing to ask people to drive into, you know, hostile territory and bring back these, you know, these hostages. But the Red Cross has seen its members killed, you know, for doing aid work. There's a huge group of the population that's dependent on the Red Cross. The Red Cross actually keeps numbers of the numbers of Nigerians that are registered missing. A lot of times when people go missing, they go to the Red Cross and say, hi, my cousin, brother, what have you, is missing. The Red Cross has 23,000 Nigerians registered missing right now. It's the highest number of any country on earth. No other country on earth has that many people registered missing with the Red Cross. So the work they do up there is incredibly important, and it's very, very dangerous for them.
And one final question on this. You talk about unintended consequences. When you think back to the 2015 inauguration for his first term of the president, Muhammadu Buhari, what could he have done differently?
I think, you know, he was elected in this wave of feeling like there were, on the one hand, he was seen as not corrupt, and he was seen as a military man. And that was the hope. And, you know, he's had 2 terms now. And I think objectively, the security situation in Nigeria has not gotten better. He hasn't, you know, lived up to the hopes, and maybe it was a lot to ask of him, but there's, you know, security challenges all over the country. The Northwest, you have this artisanal gold mine issue, you have a separatist fervor in the Southeast, you have a issue with between herdsmen and farmers in the middle of the country. It's really a tragic, the slow loosening of state control over big pockets in the country.
Yeah, it's something Emmanuel touched on towards the end of part one of our discussion. You got Boko Haram and its offshoots in the Northeast, banditry across the North, farmers and herders at daggers drawn, religious and intercommunal violence in the Middle Belt, separatist movements in the Southwest. You have other areas where there's attacks for ransom. Blessing Ibomo, is it really getting worse, or is this just the way Nigeria is?
It is getting worse. It's getting worse also because of the economic situation at this moment in Nigeria. If we look at the northern side, I believe that the situation in terms of the economic aspect would be better as having President Buhari as the president. But
why? Because he's a northerner?
He's a northerner.
A military man?
Northerner. Military. Like, that was the promise he gave to them earlier on in 2015, that when I get into the office, expect more from me. And that was what he promised the whole country. But the situation right now is, yeah, it's not at its best.
So what do you do? I mean, it's obviously two-pronged, right? There's the security response and there's the development response of things. How do you go about it? What do you do at this stage?
I mean, I ask myself, why exactly are they targeting school girls? Why is it the northern side of it? And if you look at it, I believe it's more of the Boko Haram. It's just a name, just like what Dr. Iga said. It's just a name bandit, but I believe it's more of the Boko Haram, the ideology behind it.
Is it ideology, or is it simply that they know that if we kidnap schoolgirls, we're sure to get money?
But why the northern side? Why are they targeting north? Why not the south? I believe it's more of the ideology than the money aspect of it. Because in the north, ladies are not encouraged to go to school at a young age. They get married, they are believed to be at home, have kids, you know, take care of the home. Just like what the president said, women are in the kitchen. He said that already. That was the belief. I believe it's more of the ideology than the...
Najim Ani Mashaun, do you agree?
Well, it's difficult to pull the thread. I'll go back to what Emmanuel said earlier about banditry. And you mentioned earlier also about banditry and herdsmen. We have fairly porous borders. So we do have a lot of small and light weapons coming through our borders. A lot of these are legacy problems from the collapse of Libya. We also have some issues across countries in our region, particularly Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. And ISWAP is actually quite active in those places. And obviously, kidnapping is part of their modus operandi to finance their operations. Kidnapping has become, as you said, a cottage industry in Nigeria. And we have bandits who have become bandits because they themselves were the victims of cattle rustling. And if you look at the herdsman's lifestyle, essentially everything that they own in this world is in their cattle. So if they are rustled, that's almost like being bankrupted. And the quickest way to get back that capital that they've lost to theft is to rustle other herdsmen. And now that herdsmen are carrying AK Kalashnikovs, the risk to them of trying to get the cattle is now higher. So they've graduated to rustling people. And the easiest way to rustle people is to rustle as many people as possible and to rustle them where they are plentiful, which is boarding schools. So let's not try to minimize or mitigate why they're targeting schools. This is essentially an economically driven activity by social capital networks that are pretty nasty. So that on one side is a problem. The other problem that we have is that the Nigerian government, up until recently, did not change its security chiefs who had not performed very well. And of course, that had affected morale in the military. And the military is stretched in many, many places, including the Northeast and the Northwest. But when you have service chiefs that don't really command the confidence of the men who are doing the fighting, it does affect the performance in the field. So that's another layer of the issue that we're dealing with. We also have a political class that is essentially inert at the moment because they don't really know what to do. We've got a National Assembly that has not been very active in actually promoting legislation or initiatives to deal with this. We have a government, an executive, that doesn't want to make the difficult decisions relating to the economy so that we can actually fix the problems that are affecting us. We've got an education system that has not addressed the population growth or the needs and the skill requirements of the population that we have now, many of whom have left school or left university and not able to find jobs. So you put all of that together with a fairly large demographic bulge, you do have all the indicators that create the problems that we are seeing today.
And to Blessing's point that why is this happening just in the north, you mentioned that the herders versus the farmers is one aspect of it. But do you agree with her when she says that it is partly ideology?
I won't rule out ideology, but I don't think, it's easier to kidnap girls from a boarding school. a lot easier than it is to kidnap girls from a day school. It's also easier to kidnap girls from a boarding school that's in a remote part of the country, and the more remote parts of the country are in the north.
Right.
So I agree with Blessing, but I don't think that's really a motivating factor. It'll be difficult for bandits to move out of their area to another state like in the southwest and kidnap girls in a girls' school in the southwest. It would really be difficult because they'd have to move them very long distances, and the chances of them getting caught and the logistics of it are much, 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 much higher.
All right, let's pick up on that point. Nigeria's female literacy rate at 53%, it's very low by European standards, but it's among the highest in West Africa. And if you look at the chart, the numbers plummet the further north you get, the closer you get to neighboring Niger and Chad, which, by the way, in 2018 were on 23% female literacy for Niger and 14% for Chad. So the further north you go, the worse it is, Blessing. Mm. Two quick questions for this. First of all, explain for our viewers boarding schools. Why is it so big in Nigeria?
I went to boarding school from my primary school. I was in boarding school. And in Nigeria, most parents are always very busy. I personally, my parents took me to boarding school because they're very, very busy. And boarding school, it's a place where you can be within the school environment and also feel at home. In the northern side, parents feel, you know, you have to go to the farm, you're busy throughout the whole day. So boarding school is like a home where the kids can stay together, learn. And it's not a system where you can easily get a house help like in France or in Europe. So it's well encouraged within Nigeria.
And if what's been going on discourages parents from putting their kids in boarding schools, what's that going to mean?
Yes, it is.
Will it mean taking the kids out of school, or will they be able to take them to day schools?
I mean, looking at the northern side already, it's already been discouraged for girls to go to school. So with the situation going on right now, it's going to stop them from thinking about it because they're already at risk. You know, I want to take my child to a school and I'm scared I might get a phone call, she's being kidnapped. So it's definitely going to stop girls or children in particular from going to school, not just, yeah.
Emmanuel Iga?
Yes, one very quick to bounce on what Blessing just said. I think this general atmosphere of fear for our children is there all over the north now. It's been entrenched. And it's all over the country, but it's particularly concentrated in the north. And it is not being eased by certain declarations that we hear from the authorities. Like the federal minister of defense recently declaring that, you know, Nigerians should rise up and fight back against these criminals.
Yeah, we're getting mixed messages because on the one hand,
they shouldn't be cowards.
So
I'm quoting the federal minister.
So that means more
militia. So in short, the authorities are saying we are no more capable of protecting the lives and properties of the people of this nation, which is their primary constitutional duty. And they are saying, you do the job for yourself.
Drew Henshaw, right now, we've done shows on this very set talking about what's going on in Mali and Burkina Faso, where the self-defense militias in places pop up. They seem like a great idea at first because they are motivated. But then it's more weapons and it turns into a new problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have that in the north. You have that, especially in the northeast. The civilian JTF, it's called, you know, these are young men who felt like the state's not really able to pinpoint who is Boko Haram and who isn't. So let's go, let's do the job for them. There's a lot of human rights abuses, accusations against that group. I mean, at a certain point, it becomes, you know, you're talking about people who have been living in a really traumatic situation, who are afraid for their children, afraid for their own lives, arming them. You don't have to be, you don't need a doctorate in sociology to see that this could go to a bad place, yeah.
There was a tipping point in terms of the international community paying attention. back in 2014. We had this week the UN Refugee Agency flagging the fleeing of more Nigerians across the northern border. The Maradi region in southern Niger now hosting nearly 100,000 displaced people, including 77,000 Nigerian refugees. And the UNHCR describing relentless attacks in Katsina, Sokoto, Zamfara states. So, Drew Henshaw, again, you cautioned earlier about what it means when the international community gets involved. Are we reaching a new tipping point now?
You know, what I could say about this is that in the wake of the kidnapping that that captured the global imagination, the Chibok kidnapping nearly 7 years ago, the U.S. sent drones, the British sent a spy plane, the U.S. eventually stationed hundreds of troops around the borders. And all of that is still there. All of those, the Night Stalkers, which is the army regiment that flew in the bin Laden raid that helped kill bin Laden, they're based in Cameroon. The NSA has Kanuri speakers, a language in northeast Nigeria. All that's still there. And these are not small assets, Predator drones, Global Hawk drones. That's all stationed around Nigeria. At the end of the day, you know, this is a Nigerian problem. I mean, this is exactly what Barack Obama told President Buhari in 2015. You know, this is, you're dealing with Nigerian groups that are kidnapping Nigerians on Nigerian soil. We can help you here and there, but at the end of the day, this is a Nigerian problem.
Emmanuel Iga, we're getting lots of reactions on the hashtag F24 debate, including one viewer saying in Zamfara state, the governor should prepare for a state of emergency. Expect a state of emergency. So on the one hand, there's talk about self-defense militias. On the other, there's bring in the federal government into all of this.
Yeah, that's pretty dicey. State of emergency in a state in Nigeria, by definition, means the federal government takes over the administration of that state. I don't know if the state will be ready for that. I don't think that is the best solution for now. The government of a state needs to be there. It's the state government that is actually closest to their own people. They know more what is happening. So I don't think they should set these governments aside. I don't see how Abuja authorities could go to Zamfara and know what is happening on the ground. They just have to work together, hand in hand with the state governments. Not only Zamfara, but all the state governments. I don't think they need to declare any state of emergency right now. It's just to try to make the Nigerian military more efficient, more determined to fight honestly this phenomenon and to get the true backing of the commander-in-chief of the Nigerian Armed Forces, who is President Buhari. And I don't think that is happening to the optimal level yet. That is what to work on.
We're out of time. Najima Animashaun, in 30 seconds, you agree?
I suppose so, in parts. But I would add this one other thing. We cannot solve these problems in a day. There are systemic problems that need to be fixed. And I don't think we have the patience to do that without sitting as a country and figuring out how we want to live together. And that really is a question that many people don't want to ask, but has to be asked and answered if we're going to move forward.
All right. How Nigerians live together. Something to think about. Hopefully something we'll be talking about soon with our panelists. I want to thank you so much, Blessing Iboma. I want to thank Emmanuel Iga, Najima Animashaun in the capital, Abuja, and Drew Henshaw in Warsaw. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.